to order. We have Senator Morris that's here, and Senator, you wanted to give testimony on which one? 576 or 596?
596.
What I'm going to do is I made a commitment to people that were here last week that we were going to pick up and resume the public hearing on 426. But because you're here, and we have a number of people who want to speak on 426, I'm going to take your testimony out of order. So I'm opening a public session hearing on Senate Bill 596 for the purpose of getting Senator Morris's testimony. We'll come back to that and get the rest of his testimony after we complete our other work. Senator, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. I do appreciate the courtesies that you've extended, and I will be quite brief.
You can see that we come and go. We'll have more.
Well, I understand all that. Yes. 596 is a bill that essentially the nature of the problem came to my attention serving on the emergency board, and I expressed quite an interest in the fact that our wage security fund had suffered a claim on that fund through the Eastmoreland Hospital insolvency of about $1 million. And then it also, you recall, in the 0103 or 0305 budget, we appropriated $2 million out of that fund to balance our budget. So it drew the fund down perilously low, in the range of $140,000 to $150,000. And the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries brought it to my attention that we had a deficiency in the statute that put the recovery of the labor liens when distribution is made actually in line or below other lien holders in the insolvency. As you recall, the fund provides up to $4,000 per employee when you have an insolvency, and then the fund essentially backfills wages that are due. And then the fund then has the right to go back and recover those monies out of the insolvency and the bankruptcy proceedings. But the law places that recovery in a lower standard than what our public policy is for generally for labor liens. As you know, in an insolvency, the first obligation of the corporation is to pay that labor cost. That's the first requirement. But the law, and with respect to the wage security fund, does not grant the same status. And so that's what this bill does. It grants the wage security fund the same status as exists in the public policy with respect to labor, payment of labor liens out of insolvencies. It's a good bill. It's one that I think helps preserve the integrity of the fund. And obviously our intent is to make sure that we have a fund that's available for workers when companies suffer insolvency and workers don't get paid. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to give this testimony and would ask for your support for this bill and to move it to the floor.
Thank you. Any questions for the Senator? Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I think the protocol here is I'm going to recess the public hearing on 596, and we're going to go back and we're going to reopen what we started last Thursday, a public hearing on Senate Bill 426. Okay, and I'm going to do this in panels. And let's see. I think what I'm going to do is Richard Schwartz, Mary Botkin, and Joe Schaefer. And before we get started, Council, if you want to go ahead and just give us an overview of where we're at or what this bill is.
Senate Bill 426 requires public employers to recognize a majority of employees as a labor organization if the majority of employees sign authorization cards. This is a continuation of the hearing that we had last Thursday, and we had one person testify last Thursday, and that was Representative Rosenbaum, and I put on the desk her testimony for the senator.
Okay, and who's going to start?
I will, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Bodkin. I'm here this afternoon representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And actually, the three of us are going to try not to repeat sort of what each other are saying. So we've sort of divided up our testimony, and I have the fiscal part.
Okay. And just for the record, there was one other person that did testify last week. It was Tim Nesbitt, because he was not going to be able to be here today. So, Ms. Bachman, please get started.
This bill is really it's a very simple bill. It eliminates the need for the Employment Relations Board run election when a clear majority of the workers sign authorization cards. And attached to my testimony, I'm giving you a copy of the authorization cards that we use in our organizing efforts so that you have an ability to see that the employees, when they sign that, it's pretty clear that they are giving us authorization to represent them in matters concerning wages, hours, and working conditions. When a majority of those workers, over a majority of the workers sign those cards, then going to a costly election would not be necessary, and in fact would require employers to offer to do an automatic recognition of the bargaining unit and of those employees who have signed the cards. Just so you know, I checked with the Employment Relations Board, and this bill actually saves significant dollars for them. They have a very small budget that we always struggle with to get funded. In 2003, they would have had a savings of $10,200, and in 2004, $8,925, which is nearly a total of $20,000 in one fiscal year. Now, I know that when we're talking about billions of dollars in budgeting, that doesn't sound like much. But, you know, our attitude sort of is $20,000 is $20,000, and if we can avoid that sort of costly election cycle for the Employment Relations Board to run, that it's worth the savings. This, you know, and those figures do not reflect any kind of other types of delay processes or hearings that may occur during the elections process. And as I said again, if we allow for voluntary recognition of the bargaining unit once a majority of those employees have signed cards, then it does eliminate that process. Senate Bill 426 will allow for a smooth and efficient process for a majority of the workers who support union organizing, and to make sure that when the majority of those workers sign up for the union, their voices are heard and supported. And we thank you, and we would answer any questions, and we'd urge your support.
Before we go to questions, one comment. I'm looking at this authorization card. I would strongly suggest that the union consider taking off Social Security number being listed on a postcard.
I think that we are looking at the redaction of a lot of the information that normally we would have asked for in the past that we are not going to be asking for in the future with the identity theft issues that we have.
Great. Questions for Ms. Bodkin?
Yeah.
Yes, go right ahead.
Ms. Bodkin, would you condone electing local political officials by collecting signed intent cards from 50% of the population?
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said, would you condone electing local political officials by collecting signed intent cards from 50% of the population?
Sure, why not?
What's the difference?
I'm not being sarcastic. I'm being deadly serious. I mean, if 50% plus one of the voting majority of a district want to sign a petition, then...
So you reject the idea of a free election in a ballot box where you sign your intent card or you sign your ballot in privacy?
If people want to do something different, I think that that's appropriate, but I think it's probably not in front of this committee. And, this is not electing a public officer. This is not electing a public official. This is voting to form a union.
I understand that, and I'm making an analogy, and I believe you know if a fair and private and uncoerced election is appropriate for political elections, I believe it should be for union elections also. And I don't think that we should get past that point of a free and uncoerced ballot.
All right. Any other questions, Senator Byron?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First, in your testimony, you said this bill would allow for quicker and more efficient processes, but under current law, it allows for this now, correct? But this mandated it.
Yes.
So, in effect, this bill is necessary for that if this is already allowed. That's correct.
It's a made now.
Okay. Second question, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
If this bill was amended to also do the reverse, that if 50% less one of a employee workforce was no longer had a valid signed card, that would automatically disband the union?
The easy answer is no, but I think that at this point, one of the problems that we have is that there is a lot of public money, taxpayers' dollars, spent in union elections, not by the union, but by the employers, to fight union organizing when, in the end, we usually always win those elections. But it's not before the employers have spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting the workforce to which wants the union to begin with. And I don't think, there's a companion bill working its way through the process now that says you can no longer spend public funds to support or oppose union activity. We just don't think it's appropriate for the employers to be involved in an election between the union and the workforce.
All right, who's next?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of AFT Oregon, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 426. I have submitted testimony, which I believe that you have, and I'll just highlight a few of the issues of concern that lead to this kind of bill. And essentially, we see it as an additional means of fulfilling the promise of collective bargaining and collective bargaining representation that is currently the public policy for the state of Oregon in 243-650. And in implementing that public policy, the Employment Relations Board was established. There is the provision now that voluntary recognition may be granted by the employer, and that requires two hurdles to be surmounted by public employees who are seeking representation. One is the hurdle of having sufficient numbers to seek collective bargaining, and once they do that, then the hurdle of an election and the election process, if the employer refuses or denies voluntary recognition. Voluntary recognition, while it is in the statute and has been for however many years the statute, as far as we can tell, the statute has been around, is generally ignored. And in my written testimony, I've given a number of examples where we've collected far and away, and these are not all of the examples that exist in this process, but just some from our recent experience, where we collect 60, 70, 80, 90% cards from the bargaining unit. We regularly make, when we achieve that level, a request to the employer, public employer, for voluntary recognition. and almost as perfunctorily it's denied by the employer. In public sector for education employees, we have an additional burden because after going through that process to obtain a majority status among the appropriate bargaining unit or an appropriate bargaining unit. The ERB has a policy, or as a policy, defers elections past summer time so that we, even though we may collect a majority in March or April or May, with the engagement of the election machinery and the administrative processes of the Employment Relations Board, we have to delay the time when we can actually have a representation election. And I just want to put a footnote here, and I'll come back to that in a second. And the collective bargaining statutory scheme, and it's the same in, under the National Labor Relations Act, is not about an election per se. It's about the expression of the will of a majority of employees in the bargaining unit. And the designation of that is usually through explicit authorization that's a representation that's signed and dated by the individual employees that is, in fact, what they desire to have, representation by the designated labor organization. In the failure of the employer to grant recognition, the machinery of the Employment Relations Board is engaged in that administrative framework to settle that question. But and the question is only a question because not because there's any doubt among the employees or majority of the employees, but because the employer has refused to voluntarily recognize that a majority of employees have designated the unit. So consistent with the testimony of my colleague, that this would save two things. One, the time and resources of the Employment Relations Board, and particularly the time of the employees and the employer. The promise of the statute and the statutory right to engage collectively for collective bargaining representation over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment is the promise that you have a protected right to engage with your employer to discuss those things without fear of retribution or retaliation. And the objective of the statute, and this facilitates that promise, is to allow the parties and to direct the parties to get down to it, do that job, take care of resolving your disputes and differences, and once a majority has been obtained, that can be that promise of the statute can be affected by the employees' representatives and the employer's representatives to get right down to collective bargaining and not have to wait, as the examples I've given in my written testimony, for periods of 3, 5, 7, 9, and 9 months. Those are recent examples over past number of years in our case, but there have been longer times that employees have been able to wait solely for an election, solely because the employer has not granted recognition where a majority of employees have designated the union as their representative. And I want to also underscore something Tim Nesbitt mentioned in his testimony when he appeared last week, and that is that this actually provides, in a manner of speaking, a higher threshold for the union. When the union has achieved a majority status in an appropriate bargaining unit, that's a majority. And the expression of the employees is indicated by that on the authorization cards or in a clearly stated petition that they have each individually signed and dated. The statutory scheme provides that there only be 30%, and that's to engage the machinery of the ERB. That's not a determination of the outcome. That's in order to conserve, to some degree, the use expenditure of public funds. If you don't have at least 30%, we're not going to engage our administrative processes to make a determination. But once that's engaged, the outcome of the election is determined by a majority of those who cast ballots, and there's no guarantee that 100% of the eligible voters will vote. But a majority of those will determine the outcome. So by requiring that, as this contemplates, if a majority of employees have already designated the union as their representative, that means you have to have a majority, right from the beginning in order to get that recognition. It's not simply filing a minimum sufficiency to get the Employment Relations Board machinery to work. So it's cost-effective, it's time-effective, and it fulfills the promise of the statute so the parties can get down to business and settle their differences through collective bargaining negotiations. I think that by in our support for this that it helps facilitate the promise of that statute and lessens the opportunity for long and unnecessary delays, the expenditure of public funds by public employers in the case of the higher ed system by utilizing the Attorney General's office, in the case of community college and K through 12 districts by utilizing expensive private sector law firms. All of that can be eliminated through the grant of recognition when an objective demonstration of a majority status is presented by the union.
Thank you. Joe, I'm going to go ahead and take your testimony, then we'll open up for questions for both of you.
Chair Brzezanski, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schaefer. I work for SEIU Local 503, and I'm a resident here at Salem. I'm speaking today because one of our members, Tony McCullough, who was present at the last hearing, wasn't able to speak, but he wasn't able to get a second day off. And he went through an example that's pretty pertinent to this bill. He works for the Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services, where we just organized that work site, and they did an authorization through a showing of cards in excess of 50%, and then had to go through the election process as well. It was almost as if the other half of the work site got a second bite at the apple to try to stop the rest of their coworkers from organizing. But also there was a big effort from management there to try and block the union from coming in. So we went through a really prolonged period of a lot of conflict in the work site, which ate up a lot of productivity and a lot of state resources in the process. The final outcome, once we finally did get an election, which was not just the election, but also the employer contesting which bargaining unit they would belong to or be attached to with the rest of the state workers. So it was a really prolonged process, and the final outcome was within one or two employees or one or two votes from the initial showing of cards. So what we were really hoping is to try to avoid a lot of that strife in the work site and have this showing of cards be the democratic process by which workers organize instead of having to go through two different processes. So.
Thank you. Open up this panel for questions. All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. I'm going off the list that we have. The other two proponents that I've listed are Tricia Smith and Matt Swanson. So if y'all would come forward. And is there anyone else that may have come in late or didn't sign up that wanted to speak on behalf of the bill? Tricia, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA is an independent labor union that represents 20,000 educational professionals that are working in Oregon's K-12 schools, ESDs, community colleges, Head Start agencies, park and recreation districts, and library districts. OSEA supports Senate Bill 426 that allows employees covered by PECBA to gain employer recognition of a chosen labor organization through a majority verification process. 426 provides a simplified and cost-efficient method for public workers to authorize, as proved by their signature, a designated labor organization to be their exclusive representative. 426 is in keeping with the intent and purpose of PECBA, as stated in ORS 243.656. This statute declares that the people of Oregon have a fundamental interest in the development of a harmonious and cooperative relationship between government and its employees. That recognition of public employers by public employers of the right of public employees to organize and full acceptance by them of the principle and procedure of collective negotiation can alleviate strife and unrest in the workplace, and that protection by law of the right of employees to organize and negotiate collectively safeguards employees and the public. Currently, Oregon law gives employers the option to refuse to recognize a labor organization that has been chosen by a majority of its employees to be their exclusive representative. This, as you've heard, forces employees to go through a lengthy and sometimes contentious and costly election to prove what they already have proven, that a majority of workers in the bargaining unit have chosen a particular labor organization to represent them. to allow employers to obstruct recognition by requiring the additional step of an election in this circumstance seems to us to be in conflict with the stated purpose of PECPA. Senate Bill 426 would offer a cheaper and quicker method of recognition when a majority of workers in the bargaining unit have decided what they want. OSEA is an exclusive representative of Oregon workers in 138 bargaining units. Through the years, as our units have sought recognition of OSEA as their exclusive representatives, some of them have gained voluntary recognition by employers, and some had majority status rejected by employers and were forced to go through an election process. We found that achieving the PECPA goals of harmonious and cooperative relationships between employers and employees was dramatically advanced when the employer agreed to voluntary recognition. Unfortunately, as you've heard, voluntary recognition has been the exception rather than the norm. More often than not, employers refuse to recognize the wishes of the majority of workers, thereby forcing those employees to win their PECPA rights by going through an election process. Unfortunately, when this has happened, not only have employees had to go through many hoops to win their rights, many additional hoops, but also employers have launched a campaign to defeat the effort. The months of contentious disagreement between the employer and employees that followed often created wounds that took a long time to heal. Those wounds could have been avoided if the employees' rights and wishes were recognized initially. OSEA firmly believes that the public's interest is not served by allowing employers to interfere with the right of public employees to gain representation, especially when a majority of employees have placed their signature on an authorization card designating an exclusive representative. Senate Bill 426 affirms that under PECPA, the decision to organize and the choice of representation is an employee decision, an employee choice, not the decision or choice of the employer. Senate Bill 426 will not stop the employer from launching a campaign during the card signing stage of an employee organizing effort. However, it will stop the employer from overriding the verified choice of a majority of its employees who, through signing authorization cards, have chosen a designated representative. We ask for your support for Senate Bill 426 to further the public's interest in promoting the policy found in PECPA. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson.
Okay, for the record, Chair Brzezanski and members of the committee, my name is Matt Swanson. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I did provide a handout and written testimony for you. However, I won't go over too much of it as it may be redundant from what you've heard before. I think really the position of the Oregon AFL-CIO is consistent with our affiliate unions that have shown up here today is that this is a bill about protecting the freedom to form unions. And the way that employees go about forming a union is determining some form of majority amongst themselves about if they want to be represented. Majority sign up in this instance is a free and fair way to do that. It's also a way to insulate employees from employer interference. In many cases, that is why the election process as used under the Employee Relations Board can be troublesome to employees because of the time delays and different determinations that must be made through that process. Many employers will use that time to intimidate, harass, and work against employees who are exercising their freedom under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act to form a union. So really what we're saying here is that a majority of workers who sign authorization cards should always be enough, and that can be verified by the Employee Relations Board, and that union should be recognized by the employer rather than to go through a process that's costly and ultimately can be open to abuse of employees' freedoms. So I guess that will conclude my brief testimony. I encourage you to read the handout I did give you, and we will be opening questions at this time.
Great, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Okay, I have four people that are signed up in opposition. What I'm going to do is take two at a time. Ron Wilson and George Berry. This will be followed by Tom O'Connor and John Powell.
Go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is George Berry. I'm the Labor Relations Administrator for the City of Salem. I have provided a written handout in regards to my testimony today. I'm speaking here on behalf of the City of Salem and the League of Oregon Cities. We respectfully have to oppose this legislation, primarily because the law as it is currently written in Oregon makes a distinction between bargaining units that we have to deal with. Certain bargaining units are public safety, and the whole collective bargaining process is different for public safety employees than it is for strikeable units such as AFSCME. When we have a collective bargaining issue and we have employees in a unit that may be misplaced and could very easily be misplaced under this statute, employees that in a 911 unit that might assume they would sign up for a AFSCME unit, they would be non-strikeable and subject to arbitration, whereas all the rest of the AFSCME employees would be strikeable and inappropriate for those two groups of employees to meet. Furthermore, we support the current process that allows for an open election that allows employees to vote, not only the majority but the minority of employees, to have a say in election process whether they choose to be represented by the union or not. Therefore, we would respectfully decline support for 426. I would point out that's not covered in my testimony, after listening to the testimony here today, that the three most recent additions to the AFSCME unit currently representing the employees of the City of Salem, due to consolidations of some of our 190 agreements with Marion County, have all been voluntarily recognized after the board told us that they had a majority of cards. So the election process wasn't needed, but we didn't need to see the cards either. I think there's some real innate danger for the cards to be shown to the employer. It runs a risk of causing some employers to possibly discriminate against those employees assigned cards. Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Mr. Wilson.
Yes, for the record, my name is Ron Wilson. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the Oregon School Board Association. We provide collective bargaining consultation services to K-12 school districts and community colleges in Oregon. I have provided you with a copy of my written testimony. We do oppose Senate Bill 426 for three reasons. One, it does diminish local control by removing the choice from local school boards to voluntarily recognize a labor organization. Secondly, it does diminish the ability of employees to openly select their representative through an IRB-supervised election process. And third, it does remove some fundamental checks and balances regarding the structure of what appropriate bargaining units are. I'd like to draw your attention to another statute, ORS 243.650, subsection 1. It defines what an appropriate bargaining unit is, and it requires the Employment Relations Board and a local employer who voluntarily recognizes a bargaining unit to consider what the appropriate bargaining unit is. In Senate Bill 426, it talks about a majority of employees. Well, a majority of what? What constitutes the majority? Also in that statute 243650, subsection 1, I know that it can't mean all possible employees of the employer, because we have two different types of units in school districts, licensed staff and non-licensed or classified staff. This particular statute prohibits a bargaining unit that combines both licensed employees and non-licensed employees in school districts that have more than 50 employees. So it does leave the question, what is the appropriate bargaining unit? As well as that statute does require a local employer to consider what the appropriate bargaining unit is. So what we then are left with is the possibility that with the implementation of 426 as it's written, we could have perhaps many different bargaining units within a single employer. School districts have many buildings. Could we have a bargaining unit that is represented by an organization that says we have a majority of employees in this particular building? That is a possibility. The fragmentation of bargaining units within employers is a concern for us. For example, in community colleges, they have many satellite campuses. We then have bargaining units within each of those satellite campuses. Additionally, the structure of Senate Bill 426 looks to employee desires as the way to determine whether or not a particular union is to represent them. And a subset of that, of course, if the majority of names are presented to the employer, well, what is that bargaining unit? I would like to also draw your attention to another statute, 243.682, subsection 1, which describes the way that appropriate bargaining units are constructed by IRB. The desires of the employee are only one of six different elements or factors to be considered: community of interest, wages, hours, other working conditions of employees, and any history of collective bargaining. So Senate Bill 426 really does appear to be elevating the desires of the employee above some of those other factors. There are also a number of practical considerations. When those cards, authorization cards, are presented to the public employer, what verification process do we have? There's nothing in Senate Bill 426 that talks about any type of verification process. What do the authorization cards say? Are they authorizing a particular union, or are they just authorizing a general union representation? When were they signed? Who signs them? One of the discussions that goes on at the local bargaining level is the composition of the bargaining unit. Are we talking about full-time employees? Are we talking about part-time? Are we talking about substitute employees? Are we talking about temporary employees? Are we talking about casual employees? All of those discussions are inherent in the description of the bargaining unit and goes on at the time of any possibility of voluntary recognition. This bill removes that discussion entirely. Does it then leave the unilateral and does it leave the unilateral selection of the bargaining unit to the employee union that's submitting the filing that they have a majority of employees that have signed this card? By taking that completely away from the local employer, we are allowing a unilateral determination. Now, under this bill, could the employer appeal? There is no provision for any type of appeal to the Employment Relations Board on that unilateral filing by the labor organization. One of the other aspects that this bill fails to acknowledge, I believe, is that during the IRB investigation and election process, it does allow the intervention of another labor organization to, upon a appropriate showing of at least 10% of authorization cards, to enter into the election so that employees then have both an open election that's supervised by IRB, and then they have a choice of one union versus another union or versus no representation. Choice allows better decisions to be made. This bill starts to take away some of that choice. Finally, I would like a number of the other individuals who have testified, point out to you some of the purposes of the Collective Bargaining Act. And I'd like to specifically point out ORS 243.565, subsection 5. It says, in part, that a purpose of the Collective Bargaining Act is to provide a uniform basis for recognizing the right of public employees to join organizations of their own choice. According to the Employment Relations Board, that concept of uniform basis also incorporates involuntary employer recognitions, and I provided the case citation in my testimony. Our concern, of course, is that Senate Bill 426 appears to create the prospect of non-uniform, unilateral procedures for employee recognition, and therefore we do oppose Senate Bill 426.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for either on the panel? Senator Wilson.
Chair Brzezinski, Mr. Wilson, proponents of this bill have suggested that the employers may influence unionization votes. without a free secret ballot election, is it conceivable, in your opinion, that employees could be unduly influenced by pro-union peer pressure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, that is definitely a possibility.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Mr. Wilson, the one thing that caught me at the very beginning of your testimony, your number one, diminishes local control by removing the choice of local board, school boards to voluntarily recognize a labor organization. I'm trying to grasp myself around local control because my sense is that the employees are the ones that actually are making that decision as to representation. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, how does the local school board retain local control when they're going to have to recognize them if they're verified? Through the election process that's currently provided for, or through this new process that's proposed?
One of the aspects of recognition of any labor organization is which employees are that labor organization going to recognize. The local employer can engage in a discussion with that labor organization over their assertion that they represent a majority of employees. In part of that discussion, they make a determination of what is in the bargaining unit. If the employer, the school board, and the local labor organization can agree, and there does appear to be verification, then a voluntary recognition can occur. If there is no agreement, then there is the alternative election process. It is hard to countenance that the way Senate Bill 426 is written, that is, it is in any way a voluntary recognition on the part of the employer. The employer under this bill would be required, upon submission of 51% or a majority of employees, they are then required. That doesn't appear to me to be voluntary.
I understand that. I just don't. I know we all want to use the nexus to local control. I just don't see it from my perspective where they're going to gain or lose local control under this process. It's either they're going to recognize them or they're not, and I don't see that being quote-unquote local control, but that's a difference of opinion.
Mr. Chair, perhaps it is a difference of opinion from the perspective of the of school boards. The ability to help construct what that, who is in that bargaining unit or who is not in that bargaining unit, is a critical element of local control as far as we're concerned.
I understand. Thank you very much for your testimony. If you all could step back, I have Mr. O'Connor and John Powell. And I'll also ask, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 426? How much we can start? I'm not sure where John
is. I didn't, Mr. Chair, I didn't see him. I looked a minute ago, didn't see him either.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Canby Utility Board in Clackamas County. We are wanted to go on record as opposing Senate Bill 426 because it removes the ability of the employer to request that the issue go to the ERB and that an election be held rather than simply taking the cards as presented. Canby Utility Board has two bargaining units. One is represented by a union. One represents themselves but participates in a collective bargaining process. In this case, both the contracts expired in June of 2003. Both bargaining units entered into negotiations. New contract was signed, and which doesn't expire until 2006. Sometime shortly thereafter, there was the one of the bargaining units, the non-union bargaining unit, changed their mind and turned in some cards requesting representation. Canby having the opportunity to have or conduct some basic fact-finding and go to an election if necessary, declined the request. It did go to ERB. And the ERB had determined that the request was untimely because they were still in the middle of the contract. The union at that or the bargaining unit withdrew the request voluntarily. So I guess, again, what we're concerned about is what other folks have said. We would like to continue the current situation where the employer at least has the ability to request the issue go to the ERB. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for Mr. O'Connor? Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We would have similar concerns that were just expressed by Mr. O'Connor. I won't repeat them.
Thank you. I assume there's no questions for Mr. Powell since Mr. O'Connor got off free.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 426? Now I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 426. And I'm going to go ahead and reopen the Senate bill hearing on 596 since we recessed that. Let's go ahead and close that off so we can have our tapes together, and then we'll pick up on the other two. Okay, let's see, we have two people here to testify on 596 besides Senator Morris, who's already testified, Marsha O'Miller and Dan Gardner.
Mr. Chair.
Good to see you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 596 deals with the Wage Security Fund. The Wage Security Fund is a small set-aside of unemployment insurance, which we get a biennial payment for from the Employment Department. What we do with the fund is when a business goes out of business owing wages to an employee, we can give up to $4,000 to that employee for those particular wages. What it does really is allows those particular employees to be able to make house payments, car payments, etc. Because a business has completely gone out of business through no fault of that employee. They've already earned the wages, done the work, they just haven't gotten the check. Unfortunately, it does happen quite often. As Senator Morris testified earlier, actually three things happened to the Wage Security Fund since the last legislative session. One was that the legislature did take $2 million from the fund. The second was that the projections from the Employment Department versus what the actual check that came into the fund was a $500,000 difference, so we actually got in $500,000 less than we thought we would. And the third was Eastmoreland and Woodland Park Hospitals, where we had over 380 claims from all sorts of employees, where both hospitals shut down overnight owing wages to nearly 500 employees, only 380 of which actually made claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We actually would have run out of money in that fund, and we were before the E-Board for possible appropriations for that fund when we were able to reclaim some wages from a past employer and reclaimed about $100,000, which has kept the fund solid till our next payment. By statute, we only get paid biannually on that particular fund. And basically, we were asked at the E-Board a number of questions. Senator Morris asked a vast number of questions. If maybe in economic times, is it possible that there's more of these than when economic times are better? And the answer is no, not necessarily. Eastmoreland and Woodland Park hospitals went down in bad economic times. Portland Bottling Company actually in the middle of very good economic times, which is one of our other larger cases. There's really no way to predict when this is going to happen. But there is one thing we can do, and that's to say that in law currently, the employees' wages that are owed are number one in a case when there is funds left to the company, assets in some format. We're actually much farther down the list, and by putting us on the same level as the employee, it will be able to recoup more dollars for the state to the Wage Security Fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Martha, would you like to go ahead and give us your testimony, and then we'll do questions.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marcia Ole Miller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Commissioner Gardner already explained to you the background on the fund, of what it does, where the money comes from. Currently, there are two ways that the Bureau can try to recoup money to the fund after a business has gone under. One of them involves if there is an entity or a person who we can go after for the unpaid wages. For instance, someone who was DBA, a particular business, maybe we can still find the individual or individuals to go after, that type of thing. In such a case, what we would do is issue charges, standard charges, such as we would in a wage claim, saying that the Wage Security Fund paid out money, and this person or entity is responsible to pay the money back. And they could ask for a contested case hearing on that, and that would be administered much like any other type of wage case we have. If we prevail, we could then take the final order and docket it as a judgment, as provided in Oregon statute for any agency final order. However, in a lot of cases, there's just nothing left. There's an insolvent business. There's no particular person or entity that you can identify that you could go after. However, there may be some property. And in a case like that, there's already a provision in the law, which is 652.414(4) that says that the commissioner has a lien when they have paid out wages from the Wage Security Fund. They have a lien, which would be an automatic lien without any further process on the employer for the benefit of the fund when a claim is paid. However, that lien does not have any particular priority. It just says that the exact language is the commissioner has a lien on the personal property of the employer for the benefit of the fund. The language is shall have priority over any other liens or security interests perfected after the date of the notice of claim is filed with the county recording officer. So we're just in line with anybody else who got there first. And the Oregon legislature has previously made policy determinations that labor liens should have some type of priority when a business closes down. Businesses in receivership, for instance, labor liens are to be paid right after operating expenses. So the idea that wages have a high priority is not a new notion. We feel, therefore, it would be appropriate, since this is public money and since it does represent wages, that there should be a lien that has stronger priority than currently exists in the statute. The exact language of the amendment would be that it would have priority over all other liens except labor liens and taxes, and shall have equal priority with labor liens. So that is exactly what this bill would do, is strengthen the lien that the commissioner automatically would have in that type of situation. I can't think of anything further to say about the bill. I'd be happy to take questions.
And are there any questions for either Senator?
Senator Prasansky, Director Gardner, why should labor liens have priority over liens for such things as goods and construction services and that sort of thing?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, that has been the legislative's priority for a number of years, basically because those are employees for the company, where the company went out of business through no fault of the employee. The employee actually did the work, provided the hours of employment, but didn't receive a paycheck for it. I think they're the most directly affected when a business goes out, and that's why the legislature in past sessions has made them the highest priority.
Can I follow up on that?
You may.
It's possible, Director Gardner, that those people who have provided inventory for that company or those who have provided other material goods for that company might differ with their opinion.
But Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, that's probably very true. The thing about material providers, though, is that they have a broad array of clients, and only one that has a problem where the employee works solely for that company and has no other form of income other than working for that company.
That's probably a valid comment.
Anything else? All right, thank you very much. All right, is there anyone else here who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 596? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 596, and we're going to hold this bill. I've got a request, and we'll probably be rescheduled for work session next week. And we're going to go with 576. So we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 576. And it looks like we have Boley, whoever Boley is, and I've got Martin Taylor. Those are the only two that are currently signed up. Yeah, please.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 576 adds licensed registered nurses to a list of health care providers who may sign to verify eligibility for employee under family leave law.
All right. Who wants to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We shorthanded on the sign-up sheet for the Bureau of Labor and Industries instead of listing all of our names. So Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 576 provides an addition to the list of health care providers that are already addressed in the Oregon Family Leave Act. We believe will actually help and make the efficiency of seeking medical certifications under this law easier to do for doctors and nurses within the healthcare treatment facility. Those of you who are not familiar with the Oregon Family Leave Act, it provides 12 weeks of unpaid leave for four separate purposes, for parental leave, for the serious health condition of an employee or the employee's family member, for pregnancy disability, and for what we call the sick child leave, which is leave to take home care of a child who has a non-serious health condition. There are particular reasons under the Family Leave Act where an employer is allowed to require an employee to provide a medical certification so that the employer can be certain that the employee has a legitimate reason, medical reason, to take this leave. And obviously that's a valuable tool for employers. And I've listed out for you in the testimony the various reasons why an employer and when an employer can seek that kind of medical certification. And we, as the Bureau, have a technical assistance for employers unit. Many employers will call us and inquire, well, I've got a medical certification, and it's signed by a nurse, and it may or may not have a slash after it that has the doctor's name. And so our hope in proposing and working with Senator Devlin on this legislation was to provide that the list of healthcare providers would include a registered nurse. Clearly, we know that there's a scope of practice that goes with every healthcare provider that's listed here, and we aren't intending in any way to extend someone's scope of practice here by doing this. So we want to make that clear from the start, and if necessary, would certainly work with the committee and the committee staff to address any concerns that others might have on that. And I think Martin may speak to how that would work in practice as well. So that is really our goal in having discussions with Senator Devlin, is to have this kind of clarification in the law to allow the nurse to actually document the medical certification, and the employer then can take that and rely upon it under the law and know that it is clearly someone who has the authority to provide that medical certification. This is most commonly needed in the sick child arena, where after a certain number of times an employee seeks to take care of their sick child child at home, the employer can come in and say, I'd like medical certification that your child really was sick. So they go to generally their doctor's office, local doctor's office, or a clinic, and they often are seeing that frontline nurse who's taking their temperature and you know, listening to their chest if they have a cold, that kind of thing. So the nurse is kind of the first line of the person who's seeing this sick child. We believe this will help save time and money and also provide clarity to the employer who knows that that certification would be acceptable. And we have had conversations with the Board of Nursing, and they have said they do want to make clear that this is not expanding the scope of the authority, and would look to perhaps provide an amendment to that to clarify that. And we would, again, be more than willing to talk with the committee staff about doing that. I know there are other changes made in the bill, but we will note for the record that those are not meant to be substantive in nature. There are things that legislative council did to clean up the statute and put specifically licensing references in the statute where they were not there before. So that is not something that was intended to have any substantive change to the bill. The only substantive change is the registered nurse addition.
Great, thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. This isn't a bill that we were aware of till it was brought in the form of a legislative draft to us at the beginning of session, so I started by doing a little bit of research on the problem. It's not uncommon for nurses to fill out the paperwork for family medical leave. It's not uncommon for them to then sign their name and then put a slash and indicate that it's under the delegated authority of the person who created the medical record, which is a primary care provider, a doctor, or a nurse practitioner. That's actually a practice that when I ran this bill by Dr. Bates, who I don't want to speak for, but he's sick and can't be here today, indicated it was a huge relief to him because it's a lot of paperwork, and frankly it's a pain in the rear side to fill out all those papers. So they look to their nurses to help them with that. My understanding from Boley is there's just been a few cases where an employer has said, can a nurse really be filling this out? All the nurse is doing in most of these circumstances is looking at medical records, which is what they do all the time. So this probably is just a record-keeping bill. Annette's talked to me a little bit about some circumstances where you've got sick kids, and it may be the nurse that is, in fact, verifying that for purposes of going to school that day, the kid is sick. That would fall within the scope of practice of an RN. It would be a reasonable thing for her to fill out under her own authority rather than a delegated authority. But we don't view this bill, we don't need this bill to give nurses any additional authorities to prescribe or diagnose or anything that you would call a scope of practice issue. It's just really a question of does it make sense to have a nurse go through the medical records? And just for one last piece of clarity, a lot of times when people are dealing with something more serious and they need family leave, the first time they meet with their physician, they don't have the family medical leave paperwork in front of them. I mean, that's not what they went in for. Someplace down the road, they realize they need to get that paperwork filled out. So they go to their doctor's office and try to get it completed, and it is frequently the nurse that does that job. So this is simply saying that her signature with the slash and the doctor as the primary could serve the purposes of being valid. I think that makes sense.
All right. Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the last testimony answered the questions I had. And I don't know, I guess, my comfort level and how the way folks possibly amend this would make it clear. Because when I read this bill, I thought this is what they meant, but it reads on its face that the nurse, you know, a registered licensed nurse now can practice medicine.
Yeah,
I don't think it's intended to do that now that they've had that on the record. I think if the language is wordsmithed.
All right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, actually, after talking with the Board of Nursing, I mean, I think we would have the same concern under any of those healthcare providers listed. You wouldn't want a podiatrist acting as a dentist or a dentist acting as a podiatrist. So, I mean, clearly we want everyone to be practicing within their scope, whether it's the nurse or any of the other healthcare practitioners. So we could add that very easily, I think, up in line 15, 14, or 15 in that first paragraph, the entry paragraph, so it would apply to the whole list. And and clarify that we're not intending to in any way augment, expand, or do anything to someone's scope of practice.
Paul, Mr. Chair,
please.
And I would, and from the testimony, it seems to me that, you know, the nurse is acting under the, you know, basically a record keeper for a doctor in this mm-hmm. arena. So maybe there should, maybe rather than listing it there, maybe it under what is A, big A, when you're talking about a physician, put it there, physician or nurse on their behalf or something like that, so that it's clear that it's not just a nurse seeing a patient, but it's...
I guess I need some clarification, because I think that we've given authority to some nurse practitioners.
The nurse practitioners already listed in the bill.
Right.
Right. And that's what I was checking.
Okay. So,
in the bill, we already have nurse midwives and nurse practitioners right. separately from nurses. And if the nurses are really just signing, you know, looking up records for doctors and signing today, you know, our nurse, what X or physician, maybe it should be included in under A above, or a physician license to practice, or a nurse for a physician license to practice.
Mr. Taylor. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, don't have an objection to that concept. The one thing I would point out, though, is that nurses also operate under the delegate authority of any of those other providers. They could be working for a nurse practitioner or a nurse midwife or a dentist or whomever, so it should be inclusive of all of them. And, you know, Annette has indicated that sometimes you do have, when it's a sick kid, it might really just be a registered nurse who's seeing that kid, particularly if it's happening in a school setting. And like I said, we don't have a huge amount of ownership over this bill, but there might, in fact, be circumstances where the RN, within her own scope of practice, can say, yeah, your kid's got the flu. I mean, that's something that they can say. But we haven't a great sense of ownership over that piece of the concept.
Okay, I've got Senator Wissett, and I want to go back to the Senator.
Thank you, Chair President. Just to follow up on Senator Byers and your comments, I think that what separates the RN from all the rest of these listed in this list is the ability to diagnose and prescribe. Mm-hmm. And I think that's precisely what we need to have an amendment to make sure that that's clarified. And I'm sure that's not the intent, but the RN does not have that ability. The nurse practitioner does, the midwife does, but the RN does not have the ability to designate the ability to diagnose and prescribe.
Right. And I guess following up on that, I was just wondering if we wanted to do the caveat of just under the, if you had registered nurse license under this and under the directions of their, you know, the physician or something like that, that mm-hmm. gets it back. Because my only concern is that registered nurse may be in other settings than just a particular, I mean, there's multiple different settings that mm-hmm. registered nurses are used. And so I don't want us to basically think we fixed this only to find out in 2 years. Is now being interpreted that it's only ones of physicians as it's defined under one of the other categories. So, the chair, it sounds to me that we're willing to move this bill, but we want some clarification. So, if y'all could please work with council here, let's get the amendments in so we can go ahead and get this going. Any other questions? Yes, sorry.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and it's probably just an oversight or maybe conclusion on these, and I'm not familiar enough with the terminology. But what about in case of hospitalization? Isn't usually just a hospital administrator or something filling out the paperwork? And I don't see them listed anywhere.
My guess would be, I'm assuming that whatever they're doing is under the direction of one of the licensed practitioners. And as compared to them being somewhat independent just because they're at the hospital, I think they're still there under someone else's direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, in the case of hospitalization, we still need to know the condition for which they're being hospitalized, so we would rely on their primary care provider because we do need to know, is it a condition that would be covered otherwise by the leave law? So if they were being hospitalized, for instance, for elective cosmetic surgery or something like that, just because they're in the hospital may or may not mean it's a serious health condition for which we would grant leave. So I think we do actually need a care provider to clarify that nature of the condition.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's all that's on the list for Senate Bill 576. If there's anyone else, please come forward. Not seeing anyone. We're closing the public hearing on 576. And okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 142. All right. Okay, Senate Bill 142. Looks like we've got part of the Boley crew coming up. And then we have a few others that are also signed up.
The bowling crew?
Bowling.
Try not to slur that one too hard.
Foley. All right. Commissioner, are you starting us off?
I suppose, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 142 is, makes failure to pay support enforcement division money withheld from employee pursuant to a support enforcement order an unlawful deduction. This bill has an amendment. It deletes the requirement that the employer pay the employee in trust for the holder of the support rights. I have listed on your SMS, preliminary SMS, a meeting date of February 1st. That's wrong. It's today's date, March 1st.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for holding a public hearing on Senate Bill 142. This bill really provides administrative remedy for an employee if his or her employer collects child support payments through a garnishment but fails to pay the child support to the appropriate party. Current law in situations like this only provide for the employer to or the employee to take their employer actually to court to redeem or to get those monies. Yet at the same time, they're still responsible for the child support for the child, so they actually have to double pay, if you will. We get a few complaints about this every year. It does actually happen. And this really is more of a less costly administrative remedy by making it an unlawful deduction from wage and hour law if an employer collects those monies from an employee and does not pay the child support payment to the support enforcement division. It would allow us to assess a civil penalty as well against the employer in rare instances where they would not immediately correct the situation, and it allows us the opportunity to keep other cases such as this out of the court system and hopefully to keep both employer and child support working along as they should properly.
All right. Annette, were you also going to give testimony?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm just here for questions. Okay. I have Shawnee Fuller here from Support.
Ms. Fuller.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shawnee Fuller, and I'm here representing the Oregon Child Support Program with the Department of Justice. The Child Support Program is neutral on this bill and is here for the purpose of providing information on the Income Withholding Program. With limited exceptions, the Income Withholding Program, or Oregon law rather, requires support to be paid by income withholding from the obligor's wages. Through this partnership with employers we place a high value on, we are able to collect $195 million per year in child support that we are able to forward on to families or use to reimburse public assistance. In a calendar year, we issue approximately 143,000 income withholding orders. A great number of those are accepted, some are not, because the obligor is no longer employed there. But of that 143,000, approximately 938 result in warning letters sent to the employer because the employer either failed to withhold funds as required or withheld the funds and then failed to forward them on to the program. When we send that letter, it's our information that a certain number of those comply within a short amount of time. If they do not comply at that time, they either comply later or we have the ability to take further action. That action is under ORS 25424, and it is judicial. The child support program, the holder of support rights, or the obligor can take that action, but it is, they are required to go to court to do that. The program will take that action. However, due to resource issues and workload concerns, sometimes that may not be as quick as the obligor may like, because he or she is not getting credit for that on their child support case, but money has been withheld and not forwarded to them. So this bill would allow an administrative remedy in that situation.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Burdick.
What do the employers do with the money when they fail to turn it over?
I can try. Mr. Chair.
Speculation's allowed.
Senator. I would anticipate that in a lot of scenarios, the employer is paying their wages first, and then when they get to the point of sending money to the child support program, there's not money left at that point.
They're using it for their own benefit, basically. Isn't that a crime?
I would point to the Bureau of Labor and
Oh, come on, the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it may well be in some ways, but our remedy that we've proposed here is to help the person who's trying to do the right thing and pay their child support and has had some intermediary sort of divert that money and they're out the money, they're still owing the money, and now the law only allows them to go to court and try to spend more money to go to court. So it's just a difficult, burdensome remedy now. So the bill is really just designed to get the money in the right place as quickly as possible in an administrative, investigative way, as opposed to having to file the matter in court. But it may well be that there is some basis. The current statute, which I cited incorrectly in our testimony, I apologize for that, Mr. Chair, that was my oversight. It should be ORS 25.424, does allow even to get attorney's fees and some damages for the employer failing to pass on the money appropriately, but it's the whole process of actually filing a lawsuit, finding an attorney, doing all that, that is very cumbersome. And so when we heard from employees about this, we felt like our unlawful deduction statute made a better remedy to try and address this.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I understand that concern, but I would think that a trip to the DA would be an appropriate remedy for if there is really evidence that an employer is converting this to their own use.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, you may well be right. Unfortunately, with budgets being what they are, that's probably a very low priority for the district attorney, where a letter from the Bureau of Labor and Industry stating it's an unlawful deduction and they could face a potential $1,000 penalty may remedy the situation much faster for the particular individual involved who's thereby having to double pay, both from the deduction from their paycheck and having to pay basically out of their paycheck to take care of their obligation of a child.
And I certainly agree with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for this panel? Senator Byer.
Thank you. The civil penalty provision of this bill, there is not, at least I don't see, there's civil penalty for any other of the violations of 652.610.
We don't, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, good observation. We don't have a civil penalty for other unlawful deductions, and the civil penalty here is only being proposed for this particular type of unlawful deduction.
I guess, Mr. Chair, for a follow-up, if you don't need it for any of the rest of these, why would you need it for this one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, actually, I wouldn't say that we don't necessarily need it for other unlawful deductions. I don't believe that that would be a passable bill, though. This particular one, why we need it for this one is because this is happening. It is really happening to real people out there. And without the authority to assess a higher penalty, it's harder to get an employer in compliance. There are very few other unlawful deductions that we run across. Some are, for instance, charging for uniforms, when that's an unlawful deduction. Usually by sending out a letter, when those particularly happen, it's happening to all the employees in an establishment, not just one individual, and sending out a letter stating what the law is and, saying that you're probably going to conduct an investigation across their entire business is generally enough for that employer to get back into compliance. This is one individual usually within a small company, and without the civil authority or the ability to assess civil penalties, it's less likely to get the employer in compliance.
Mr. Chair, I guess the testimony earlier was that the employer probably didn't have the money to pay the child support to the support enforcement when the time came to write that second check. So compounding the problem with a civil penalty seems maybe counterproductive. I mean, if you don't need the authority for the rest of it, I don't understand why you're going to have civil penalty authority for this one area of this one chapter of law.
I hear what you're saying, Senator. I guess the thing is, if a person's required to pay child support and they've had that as a deduction, and then for whatever reason the employer is not complying with that, it really puts the person who's trying to make good to their kids, in this case, in a pretty awkward situation. And I don't know if a employer should be able to utilize that money to pay off another debt they may have, instead of doing what is really the employee's money and just basically saying, instead of giving it to me in my own check, it should be going this other direction.
Well, and I don't argue with that. It's just that, these are all unlawful deductions of payroll. And so why you're taking one of them now and saying this one is more important, I don't agree with that. It seems to me that if you don't need it for the rest of them, you don't need it for that one. And I have no problem. I want people to pay the child support. I don't want, employers taking money and not passing it on. But I disagree with the civil penalty part of it.
I understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if I might add one other thing, it is a violation in this particular case of a court order for the individual to pay child support where any other deduction is not.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Matt, is it Minahan? Please come on up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Minahan. I'm a lobbyist for Dad's America. I'm here on behalf of Dad's America and in support of Senate Bill 142. Dad's does have some members that have paid child support through employee withholdings. And in the case where the employer does not send that on, it really doesn't matter to the dad. The dad's still liable to pay that support. And Dad's America feels that Senate Bill 142 kind of remedies that issue. And I don't have to point out, I'm sure, how important child support is, but I will point out child support is a very serious issue. If child support's not paid by a father, driver's license can be revoked, and in many cases even a jail sentence imposed. And many fathers have been sent to jail for not paying child support. So it's a serious issue. Dad's in-house attorney, Greg Austin, was actually planned to speak today, but he was held up in court, so I apologize for that. He will be forwarding on a letter that's highlighting specific cases that our members have dealt with with regard to this issue, and he will be obviously supporting Senate Bill 142. I plan to close here, but I will point out, Senator, you had a question before about going to the DA, a dad being an employee and a dad going to the DA for legal help. I would point out that I don't think that would be a great situation to put a father in terms of trying to get, it wouldn't be a great employee-employer relationship going to try to get your boss thrown in jail. So again, we feel like Senate Bill 142 is a great remedy for this. And I take any questions at this time.
Thank you very much. I think you may get one or two.
One quick question.
Chair Pajanski, why would this misappropriation of court-ordered withholding not constitute a contempt of court?
My perspective is the contempt of court would may not be able to go against the employer unless the order was directing the employer to follow, as compared to the individual father or spouse that has the order against them. I'm just guessing.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, here we got an attorney.
Well, I don't do this kind of law, but I'll tell you my you know, legal opinion. It's free. You get what you pay for. I think it is contempt of court, because it is a violation of court order. But the trouble is, what does that get you? You have to go to the court. The judge signs a contempt order. But then what? I mean, and most contempt orders have some sort of penalty built into it, such as that they will then impose a fine, or they will then do this, they will then do this. So I don't know what that gets you in this case. That's my two cents.
We have more opinions here.
Oh, well, I have an opinion too, but I'm going to keep it quiet for now.
Oh. Okay.
He wants to charge us for her opinion.
Any other questions? All right. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 142? Not seeing it, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 142. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 142. Council, we have a dash one amendment, and I wonder if you want to review that with us.
The dash one amendment is delete after line 14 on page 2, after the word deduction, place the period and delete the rest of the line in line 15. So the effect of this amendment is to delete the part that said that this amount would be held in trust for the holder of the support rights. My understanding, and we might want to ask the agency or the support enforcement division about this, is that they didn't want to hold money in trust. And that was troublesome.
All right. Does anyone want us to call someone up here for more explanation on the dash one?
I understand it, Mr. Chairman. If I understand it, anybody.
I'm not going there. All right. So that's as clear as mud or whatever, then chair is willing to entertain a motion regarding the dash one amendments. We have a motion to move Senate Bill 142-1 amendments. Is there anyone in opposition to incorporating dash one into the bill? Not seeing or hearing any. They are amended into the bill and
moved to the floor to be passed as amended.
Senator Beyer has made a motion to move Senate Bill 142 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm just getting waived that because I'm sorry. We don't have our fiscal yet.
I thought you said we.
I'm sorry.
Okay, fine.
Chair, I'd like to withdraw my motion.
Thank you very much. So, and we'll close this current. Just for the record, what we have done at this point, the bill has been amended with the dash ones, but we're waiting for the whatever fiscal statement we get before we take any action on the bill as it's been amended. But it has been amended. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 142. And we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 148. Council.
Senate Bill 148, we heard on February 8th, and it prohibits an employer from retaliating or discriminating in any way against an individual because they applied for family leave, inquired about family leave, or invoked the provisions of the Oregon Family Leave Act. There's no amendment. We had testimony in favor from Bowley, William Stark attorney, Steve Lanning from the AFL-CIO. We had testimony against from J.L. Wilson from the National Federation of Independent Business. We did have a discussion in committee about the definitions of retaliation and discrimination. We had worked with Bowley on an amendment possibility, and I believe that those definitions were troublesome to put in statute for other reasons, and so this bill is coming back to you for
for the work session.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I don't see a fiscal on this. Do we have a fiscal? We don't have the same problem again.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at, too, unless...
I don't see a fiscal issue on this bill.
Yeah, I don't think there is one, but I guess what we have here on the SMS, it just says may have fiscal impact statement not yet issued.
Yes, we're not ready on this one.
And so...
Oh, we are. No.
No expenditure?
Yes, no fiscal.
Okay. Okay, so, on the record, we have something that's from a legislative fiscal that's dated February 7th for Senate Bill 148 as it was introduced, saying no expenditure impact. So that would mean no physical.
That's right.
All right. So, Chair is willing to entertain a motion. And Mr. Vice Chair, I don't know if you want to give one on this one or not.
Let's let your Vice Chair off on this one. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 148 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 148 to the floor as originally drafted with a due pass recommendation. I think there's going to be a difference of opinion on this one, so we probably should take a vote. A registered vote?
A roll call vote.
How about that?
Registered, too.
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Buttigieg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 148 will pass the floor with the pass recommendation. I'll carry this one. And, Council, do we have any other things that we need to go over?
We've
got the plans for
the travel meeting in Cottesville. We wanted to talk about Mexican food.
Yeah. Just for everyone, I guess what we're trying to do is accommodate our possible needs if people want to eat before going to end of the meeting on Thursday at 6. We're scheduled to meet from 6 to 9. I've asked Ms. Ron to check with a couple of restaurants, and we've got some information. There's a Mexican food place that comes highly recommended by people that are part of the local elected officials that is open that could accommodate us. There's also another place that normally would not open until 5, but they would accommodate us if we wanted to eat there by opening up 15 minutes early. It's more of a what I call a Northwest cuisine type of food. So depending on what people's desires are.
I defer to my committee.
Okay, fine.
I like both.
Like Bull? Any? Okay.
Food, I'll eat it.
All right, so I think we'll take care of that with staff. Is that anything else?
Executive decision.
All right, executive branch decision here. We'll close the Senate Commerce Committee for today. Thank you.